Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Welcome back this evening. We had a nice time on Harinam this afternoon. The sun came out. Lord Chaitanya benedicted all the devotees and everyone in the square this afternoon. So, of course, last night we were talking about my very first meetings with Srila Prabhupada. And this morning we continued with that. I actually told some stories the very first few days that I was his servant, for those of you who were here. Those who weren't here, you can find out about that also in my book. He can read them to you in the morning. And so we're going to continue on this evening, and then we're just going to go off in the Srila Prabhupada's, some of his leela here, his manifested leela here. One thing I kept thinking of you from last night, you said you weren't a devotee. And I remember once Prabhupada asked, a reporter asked Prabhupada, he said, how many disciples, how many followers do you have? And Prabhupada said, everyone is my disciple. He said, some know it and some don't. You're also a follower of Srila Prabhupada, otherwise you wouldn't be here now. But Prabhupada took the whole world. Huh? He had one disciple. His name was, I can't think of his name now, Vishal. He was a very funny boy. He's more short and round and used to do a lot of book distribution. And then he went into Vrindavan. He was in Vrindavan for some time when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. And I remember when I was Prabhupada's servant, he would always, whenever Prabhupada, he would get into Prabhupada's room, or if he would see Prabhupada walking outside, he would always just start chanting all these prayers. You know, and Srila Prabhupada saved the whole world, Prabhupada being the savior of the universe and spiritual master of the three worlds. He would say all these things, you know, and Prabhupada would just smile. And one time when he walked outside and he started, and Prabhupada, savior of the universe and the whole worlds and the three worlds, and Prabhupada looked at him, he said, why don't you do something practical? That's what it was. Prabhupada said that, right? To his own godbrothers, huh? On his spiritual master's his appearance day, when he read that one Vyas Puja homage, and he said, it's not simply for ringing the bells, you know. He said, real worship, he said, is to perform the mission of Guru Maharaj, you know, of our spiritual master. So we know Prabhupada's mission. He made it so clear what he wanted to do. From the moment I was with Prabhupada, as I was saying, is all he did was give Krishna. And right up until he left this world, which this year is the 30th anniversary of Srila Prabhupada's disappearance from this world, and of course in Vrindavan, and I think it's on November 15th, around November 15th, it'll be the 30th anniversary of Prabhupada's leaving. So long ago, it seems like it just happened. As I said, you know, most of us, some of us youngsters, we thought that Prabhupada would be here till around now. Maybe he would leave when he was 100 years old or something. But it was definitely, his time here was much too short. So after I became Prabhupada's servant, there was one more story I want to tell. In the early times, it was in, because we were talking about Los Angeles and New Torque. And the garden, I was talking about being in Prabhupada's garden in Los Angeles. And Prabhupada liked that garden so much, you know. In fact, he liked it so much that when they were building Mayapur, you can see that in that Mayapur book as well, Prabhupada told them on the top floor, because they had the big roof there, and Prabhupada would go up on the roof, and he told them to bring dirt up there and to make a garden. He said, just like my garden in Los Angeles. He says, every day, and he told them, he said, in the evening I go out there when the sun is setting and sitting in that garden. He said, so you make a garden like that garden in New Dwarka. That's how fond Prabhupada was of this. It was just this little garden. It was such an amazing place. And, of course, it was Vrindavan. It was Prabhupada in there. It was this most amazing place. And when we had gotten there, I remember, as I was saying, I was there with Kirtanananda, and one of the days we went into the garden to take darshan of Srila Prabhupada, and I remember it was just Prabhupada was sitting there, and Kirtanananda was there, and I was there, And this brahmachari boy came. He was a young brahmachari, my age. He was 21, 20 years old. And he had just recently moved into the temple in New Dwarka, as we all did then. We just moved right in, whatever. It didn't matter what we were doing, if we were in college, if we had jobs, if we had vehicles, or, you know, you just left everything and you would just move into the temple. And you would shave your head that day. That was it. You shaved your head, you put on saffron. We always put on saffron right away. We became brahmacharis immediately. So he had done that. And this garden in New Dwarka, the parents of this boy had helped establish that garden. So they, mother knew horticultural work and landscaping, so they helped put the garden together. Their son was in the temple. So they had gotten darshan of Srila Prabhupada. And this, again, this was before I was even Prabhupada's servant. So we were sitting there, and Kirtanananda was there, and this brahmachari came in with his parents. It was very often would happen, and, you know, of course we all offered obeisances, and they were young. By our standards then, I would say they were old. Now I say they were young, because they were probably like 40 years old. And the boy Kurunder was there, and he introduced him and said, "This is brahmachari, this is their parents, and they have helped, you know, put this garden together and all." Prabhupada said, "Thank you very much." And he said, "And this is their son." And Prabhupada looked, of course, at the mother, and he said, "Your son is a very nice boy." And of course, the mother, all mothers know their sons are very nice boys. So the mother agreed. She said, yes, I know. And then she said, "But since moving in the temple, he's lost all his ambition." She said he was going to school. He was in college. He was studying to do whatever, you know. But now, she said, he has no ambition. He's just living in the temple. And Prabhupada looked and he said, "Yes." He agreed. He said, "Yes." He said, "The devotee just wants to serve Krishna. He has no ambition." And, you know, I was a little surprised Prabhupada said it that way, but it was Prabhupada. Whatever he said was perfect, you know. And he said, "The devotee has no ambition. He just wants to do some service for Krishna." And Kirtanananda Swami at the time was there. He was almost 30 years old at the time, and he was Prabhupada's first disciple, Prabhupada's first sannyasi. So Kirtanananda chimed in and he says, "Is what Prabhupada means to say is he has no material ambition." And Prabhupada shouted, he said, "No." He said, "The devotee has no ambition. He said he just wants to do a little service for Krishna." And that was, for me, that was very instructive as well. And when I was with Prabhupada, sometimes his disciples would do that. They would think that Prabhupada didn't properly explain himself, or maybe he didn't understand English so well. And they would say, they would like try to almost correct Prabhupada, and I would always become so bewildered. Prabhupada was pure devotee, Nitya Siddha, was perfect in every way, and he always knew just what to say. And of course, from this perspective, now looking back, you can understand, those of you that know some of our history in this kind, Kirtananda, he had a lot of ambition, which later on destroyed, you know, him and New Vrindavan and so many things. So Prabhupada, he would give instructions, and those instructions could always be, could be for one person, could be for two, it could be for everyone present. We just could never understand always what Srila Prabhupada said and how he said it. But the one thing I knew was whatever Prabhupada said, he knew what he meant to say. There was not ever a mistake. Once Brahmananda and I, we were sitting with Srila Prabhupada in his room, and this was in India, some city, maybe Hyderabad or Ahmedabad. And of course in India you would have at that time you would have the clay water pots, because they keep the water nice and cool. They stay in the clay pot and it stays cool by nature's way. Because when the water was in the pot, and if it was hot out, is what would happen, the cool water would come to the outside, right? And then that would evaporate and keeps the water inside cool. So anyway, we're sitting there, and Brahmananda, who was also, he was older, he was one of the first Prabhupada's first disciples, and he was an English major in school. He had his degree in English. And we're sitting there, and there was water on the floor because the pot, you know, the water wasn't leaking, but the water was dripping down. And Prabhupada said, "Oh, this water is leaking from the pot, Srila Prabhupada." And Prabhupada looked at it. He said, "No," he said, "it's percolating." And Brahmananda looked at him and he said, "Percolating?" He said, "Yes, that the water is percolating through the pot." And Brahmananda said, "Questioned." He said, "I don't think that's the correct word." And it was funny. See, when we grew up in America, we knew one thing. We all knew growing up watching television was coffee. They were cooking these things they call percolators. And the water would go in, it would go up to the top in this little round, and it would just go back down again through the coffee. So that was a percolator, and that's what we understood about percolation. But so Brahmananda immediately, and I thought coffee percolating in there, but what is that? You know. So Brahmananda actually left the room, and Brahmananda went and looked it up in the dictionary because he was so sure that he was right and Prabhupada was wrong. And he looked it up, and of course, under the definition for percolation was exactly what Prabhupada described, what that water was doing, which was seeping through the pot, and it was a process of percolation. So we both looked and we just laughed, you know. We thought, you just never question anything, you know. Don't even think about questioning Prabhupada, what he says, or how he defined things, or he just knew, you know. And he knew. He knew everything. It seemed about everything. Mekala, she was there when this happened. This was at Bhaktivedanta Manor in 1973. And Shama Sundar, Prabhupada's secretary, he loved Prabhupada so much, and of course still loves Prabhupada so much, because Prabhupada always had big, gigantic ideas. You know, Prabhupada would say, you know, take over the island of Fiji. And he didn't think small. He would say, this can be the first Krishna conscious country. You know, he would talk in relationship to countries and whole islands, and you can do all of this. So Shyama Sundar, he liked that spirit. It was Shyama Sundar who brought George Harrison to the temple. Imagine that one person, what he did. How many people heard the Hare Krishna mantra because of George Harrison? If you looked in early ISKCON, Prabhupada's disciples, so many hundreds and hundreds of them will say the first time they heard Hare Krishna was from My Sweet Lord, George Harrison. So anyway, that was one person that Shyama Sundar brought to the temple just by standing outside Apple Studio with his dhoti and kurta and Shay Teddy. George went right up to him. So anyway, he liked that spirit and Srila Prabhupada. And every day Prabhupada was meeting, he would bring, of course George Harrison was coming then, he was already loved Prabhupada so much, so he would come to the manor, and Prabhupada stayed there for a month. And I remember different performers came, Allen Ginsberg came, and I forget what her name was, Lakshmi Shankar, I guess Ravi Shankar's sister. She was there one day. Another day, Dhanabin was another performer. And one day, this one young man came, and he was the number one race car driver at that time. This was 1973, and I don't remember his name. But he was like the biggest name in all of car racing in Europe. And he came to see Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada talked with him for over an hour. And even Mecca will tell you, we were sitting there, and she was hiding in the next room. Prabhupada's bathroom was there, and then he got his bedroom was there. So Prabhupada talked to him about engines, car engines, and internal combustion. And he just conversed with him, just like he was in his pit crew or something, you know. And it was just hilarious. Prabhupada could just—he could converse with anyone. And I remember it was so funny. Even when I first went to Vrindavan with Srila Prabhupada, and this is where we're going to go next, this was in October of 1972, and Guru Das was president, him and Jamuna, they were staying in Vrindavan at that time. And they were acquiring the Krishna Balaram land at that time. There was nothing there. But Prabhupada would go on his morning walks. And it was so funny because on the morning walk, Guru Das would be walking by Prabhupada and he would point all these things out and Srila Prabhupada, this is this place and this is going on here. And this. And Prabhupada would go, oh, yes, yes, yes. Prabhupada had lived there for years and years. But he let him be like the tour guide as Guru Das was expressing all his knowledge of what was happening in Vrindavan about his phenomena. And then he would just always say something. He would always say these little things that you just, like we were walking down the road and there was a vulture and it was on top of one of the homes. It was like a dome and it was standing. And Prabhupada said, oh, very bad omen. Just very bad omen. And you just keep walking, you know. So he would just drop these little things. At the manor, I told you yesterday how Prabhupada would give you these little tests that weren't really tests, but he would ask you things, you know. So he was at the manor. It was just like one of these days. The sun was shining in at the glass. It was called stained leaded glass, you know, the diamond-shaped leaded glass in the windows. Very nice. And it overlooked this big lawn. Next to the lawn, there was like a one-acre pond. All this is still there. And so this was right from Prabhupada's sitting room. It was a very nice place. So Prabhupada would walk around. The room was almost this big. Almost as big as this thing. And he would walk around and he would chant. And he would just look out. So one day he went to the windows and I'm sitting there for some reason. And he looked out the window and he said, so, he said, what is the most beautiful animal? And that was a question, that was a test. And I was being tested again. I thought, oh, the most beautiful animal. I was thinking, I think. And anyone want to guess what the most beautiful animal?
Horse.
Someone's got it, right? So I thought, well, has to be the cow, right? That was the safe. See, I always went for safe with Prabhupada. Say something very safe. So I said, the cow? And Prabhupada looked at me and he laughed. He said, no. He said, a cow is not beautiful. He said, Krishna's favorite animal, but not the most beautiful. He said, the horse. Yeah, the horse. He said, it's horse. He said, it's very beautiful. The muscle structure, everything, the horse. He said, I don't even know why he was thinking about it. There were no horses on the horse. But somehow he thought to ask him that. So he said, the horse. How did it go? Come back to one. How did it go? Okay.
Did it go?
She was delayed a few minutes. So, and then from that same window, it was a different day, and Prabhupada's standing looking out the window, and birds were flying around, and he looked at me. He said, if you have a boil, he said, you can put pigeon stool on it. He said, and it'll draw the boil out. He said, it works very well. So I just said, yes, bro. So at that time in India, too, you go to India, we were always getting boils because boil means heat, excess heat, right, according to Ayurveda. And especially in mango season, we had, you know, as devotees, we had no control, so we would eat inexpensive, tasty mangoes and juhu all the time, and you would boils would come. So whenever I would see a god brother or sister with boils, I would always tell them, Prabhupada said, put pigeon stool on it. And no one would ever do it. And I never tried it. But these were one of the cures Prabhupada had given us. So we had these little things, as we were saying, these tests that were so sweet. And it showed Prabhupada was a person. He was a person, a pure devotee, but he was a person. He had personality, he had likes, he had dislikes. He was very humorous, as I said, my favorite thing, Prabhupada's sense of humor. we were on an Air India flight, and just going internally, like from Delhi to Bombay or something. And we boarded early, so again, Prabhupada, when he went into an airplane, he always sat at the window, always took the window seat, and then I would sit next to him. So that was the program. So we got on, he sat by the window, and I'm sitting next to him, and people are boarding. And it was Air India. So they have music playing, and it was classical Indian music. Sitar and tabla, like that. You know? So we're sitting there, and imagine you're sitting next to Prabhupada, so what do? You just keep your hand in your bead bag and trying to chant. You know? So I'm just sitting there. And Prabhupada's sitting next to me. And he looked at me. He said, do you like, he pointed up because the speakers were above us. He said, do you like this music? And immediately I became full of fear. Because I thought, what do you say, you know? Do you like it? And I'm thinking, well, if I say I like it, that's just Maya, right? It's just, you know. So I just looked at him. And I looked, and finally he said, it was very nice. I said, yes, Prabhupada. So I missed another chance just to be myself with Srila Prabhupada and just express, you know, my own feelings and likes and dislikes, because I was afraid. Imagine, I was afraid Prabhupada would think I was in Maya. That's how silly I was. I was always in Maya. And he knew. But he was very merciful. And it wasn't a test. He just wanted to know if I liked the music. And even at that time, sometime in the early 70s, Prabhupada would allow us on the plane, we would take vegetarian plates, you know. And Prabhupada usually would have puri and sabji, and he would bring that for a flight. But sometimes they were coming down with the plates, he would say, okay, take. So we would take the plates, you know. And the one time we did it, Prabhupada again, he's sitting at the window. And I was, you know, a devotee now for 2 years. And we got our plates from the airplane. And in those days, they were just horrible. Now they're just, you know, really nasty. They don't even give you food on planes anymore. But at that time, they would give you like a meal. So they put down these vegetarian plates, and I put one in front of Prabhupada, and I put one in front of myself. And then I opened up the puri and the sabji. We had puris and sabji in front of us. And Prabhupada started, you know, he would break the puri and push in the sabji, and he's eating it. And on my plate was these dinner rolls, you know, like you get on the plate, this bread, this. And on an airplane, you can imagine, you know, they're not the greatest. They're hard and cold, usually, because they were inside the plane thing somewhere. So these cold. And I always love bread. You know? So I'm looking, so I get my bread, and I get my butter. I'm buttering Prabhupada sitting right next to me. And I now, you know, it's just like stale thing. I'm chewing on it very happily. And he looked at me. He said, do you want my bread? I said, yes, Prabhupada. So he gave me the bread. Then he looked at me. He said, how can you eat that bread? He said, we have nice puris cooked in ghee. He said, in sabji. He said, how can you eat that bread? And I was... So that was the other thing, ghee. See, and that was ISKCON. ISKCON was ghee. Always in ISKCON, and from the moment Prabhupada went to America, Prabhupada cooked in ghee. He had no money even. Prabhupada made ghee. If you look in his, which came out just some years ago, his diary, right, he would catalog everything he was doing, spending 15 cents, you know, on a thing of pepper, ground pepper and salt, you know, 40 cents and bananas, and then he would buy butter. And he turned it into ghee. And everyone, in 1971, when I moved into the temple, one of the first things I learned how to do was make ghee. And we never had any money in temples. We lived day to day. I mean, literally, you would go out and you would collect quarters, you know, quarter dollar for BTGs, and whatever you collected, then you would go and you buy your things, and we would get fruit and vegetables out of the, you know, the dumpsters behind the supermarkets, you know, that's how poor we were. But we had ghee, and we only cooked in ghee. We never, oil was unheard of. There was no oil in temples. And of course, Prabhupada had said oil, you know, oil, he said, was meant for the outside of the body, ghee for the inside of the body. And of course, this is Ayurveda. This is like just common, healthy knowledge. But everything we did, all the feasts and all, and Prabhupada said there are two kinds of prasadam. He said opulent and sumptuous. Imagine, it was sumptuous, and above sumptuous there was opulent. So he said opulent means ghee and sugar. That's opulent. And he said, that's what we offer to the deities. The deities, you make puris and halava, you know, everything nice, opulent. He said, and sumptuous means very tasty. He said, and the devotees, he said, every day they should eat very tasty prasadam. He said, properly spiced. He said, but not so much ghee and sugar. That was reserved for the Sunday feast. And then we would eat opulent. And we ate very opulently at that time. Again, and this was even in the early days, in the Sunday feast, they know we would have, there was always puris, and there was always a curd sabji. Usually they would always make this one fried paneer sabji with tomato and peas, right? Potato, like that. And then you would have cauliflower pakoras. They were the standard pakoras. We didn't have like potato pakoras, you know, it was cauliflower because they were the tastiest pakoras. And samosas, you know, and not these gigantic ones, so you only have to make one per person. We would make small ones, proper ones. So you had to make hundreds of them. And each one you would fold over, so it was very artistically done. And the inside was, it wasn't potatoes, like now you see in samosas, potato. Everything's potato. This was also cauliflower and peas, which was cooked in the wok until it turned into this dark colored mash that was spiced very nicely, and that was inside the samosas. And then there was always a chutney and sweet rice. And good temples, they would have gulab jamun, and they were called ISKCON bullets. Because one gulab jamun, you were finished, would kill you, then you would have to become a devotee just by attending one Sunday feast. So Sundays, everyone was always very intoxicated by prasad, and it was so wonderful. And Prabhupada said that was our secret weapon, prasadam. And he said, not everyone can digest the philosophy. He said, but everyone can digest prasadam. I was talking about George Harrison when he was there at the manor, and he said, eat. And George Harrison, he was a small fellow. He was maybe 5'6" or something, about that tall, very thin. When you saw him, he was just this little, humble, wonderful devotee fellow. And so he would come and probably rub his head and sit him down. And of course, the devotees would make nice prasad, like a mekkala would cook, and these kind of things, right? Pakoras and samosas and halava. And they would bring it to George, and he would eat. Prabhupada, I'm not really hungry. And Prabhupada would say, take prasad. And George would eat. And then they would bring more. And he'd say, oh, Prabhupada, I'm so full. And Prabhupada would say, no. He would say, take prasad. And he said, prasadam can never hurt you. The more you can take. But it was always cooked in ghee. So which also happened at Bhaktivedanta Manor. When I was there in 73, we went to this nice... Prabhupada, when he was outside of India, it was very rarely went to a program outside of the temple. See, we didn't know that process in the West, that you would invite, you know, the sannyasi, the sadhu, and his disciples. But even in India, in England at this time, Indians were living there. So they knew immediately, they would ask Prabhupada. And this man, he was Prabhupada's disciple, Shiradakshai. And he invited Prabhupada over with his disciples, which at the time were about 20, 25 people living at the manor, while Prabhupada was there in 1973. So, myself, Shamasundar, Prajumna, we were with Prabhupada at that time. And I remember hearing this rumor that they cooked in oil. It was like a warning that was sent out, because we wouldn't eat anything cooked in oil. See, this is something that would happen in India. So we were cooking in oil. But, you know, we knew this was not good. So before going, I had heard they were cooking in oil. And anyway, we went to the program. There's a picture of it in the book here. And Prabhupada was sitting like in a chair at the front of the room, and the devotees were lined up in rows. And the family served us all, and of course it was wonderful. It was puris and halava, nice subjis and drinks. And the devotees always loved prasadam. We all eat to our full satisfaction. And Prabhupada was just sitting, he was taking prasadam. And then we went back to the temple, back to the manor. Prabhupada went into his room, and brought him into his room. Then I went back to the servants' quarters with my godbrothers. And the bell rang. So I went in and they offered obeisances. And I sat up. I said, "Yes, Prabhupada." And he looked at me like very coyly. And he said, "So how did everyone like the feast today?" And I said, "Oh," I said, "it was very nice, Prabhupada. I didn't know it was kind of very nice." He said, "Oh, good." He said, "So everything is okay?" I said, "Oh." I said, "Well, actually," I said, "Prajumna told me he doesn't feel well." He said, "His stomach, you know, is upset." And I said, "Prabhupada," I said, "we had heard that they were cooking in oil." And Prabhupada said, "Hmm." He said, "Yes." He said, "But Prajumna ate 10 puris." And I was like, I didn't know what anyone ate, you know. And I said, "Oh, okay." And then I thought, I was feeling in my stomach. My stomach was upset, you know. And I knew I didn't eat a lot at all. That much I knew, because I was being careful. And I looked at Prabhupada. I said, "Yes, Prabhupada." I said, "But I don't feel so good either." And I said, "I hardly ate anything." And Prabhupada said, "Yes, that's true." He said, "But you did eat 4 puris." And I thought, wow, you know, I just shook my head and said, "Yes, Prabhupada, I didn't." And Prabhupada just smiled and I left the room, and I thought, here, we're all just taking prasadam, and Prabhupada seeing Prajumna's eating 10 puris. I had 4 puris. He knew what everyone was doing in the room. And so, but, wasn't good eating these puris fried in oil. But as one of our campaigns as we travel is to, because the deities, of course, they don't eat oil. They don't, you know, they'll only eat nice food. Like Prabhupada said, for the deities, it's ghee and sugar, nice opulent. So sometimes as we travel, and they say, "Well," you know, and then they say, "Well, who are you offering it to? Because Krishna is not accepting it, so who's accepting this food?" So, yes. Anyway, Prabhupada, see, these are some of the things Prabhupada never really even talked about. It's like I described Prabhupada's schedule. And Prabhupada would go to bed by 10 o'clock at night, and he could rise around 2 in the morning, and the way he had his meals, everything he did, you'll see it was very much according to Ayurvedic standards. Ayurveda, they say you should take rest by 10 at night, because your body, all the airs, according to the different hours of the day, your body acts in certain ways. Like it says, rising early in the morning, if you're sleeping after 6, actually your body, it puts poison into your body, your organs, poison goes into your body. So all these things which come, if you're Krishna conscious, if you're following a Krishna conscious lifestyle, it's all going on naturally. So Prabhupada never stressed all these different things. But we can see practically he followed a very Ayurvedic style. But he didn't speak from it on that level. Like I mentioned Vrindavan, now we're going to Vrindavan. And I became a servant right around the middle of September. So as we were flying, I remember one of the first flights, Prabhupada said to me, so, he said, we're going to Vrindavan for Kartik. I mean, at that time, we hardly even, Kartik, didn't even know what it was. And I knew what it was, but the month of Damodar. So imagine now, Prabhupada's staying in his rooms at Radha Damodar Temple, and he's going to stay there for a month. And Prabhupada was very excited to go to Vrindavan. So on one of these flights, it was weeks before we're getting there, and he said, we're going to Vrindavan for Kartik. He said, at Radha Damodar Temple. And he said, we'll be there for the whole month. And he said, every day, he said, I'll give class from the Nectar of Devotion by Srila Rupa Goswami. Samadhi is right there at Radha Damodar Temple. This was Prabhupada's home. And he said, you can read. He said to me, that you read from the Nectar of Devotion. He said, and at some times, he said, I'll stop you. He said, and I'll make comments. So he had all this in mind as we were getting to Vrindavan. This is how excited he was. Imagine now, this was, he had been there a few times since 1965 when he left India for America. But this was his first big festival in Vrindavan since he had left 7 years ago. Now he was going back to Vrindavan with his Western Vaishnavas, his American and European disciples. And he was letting everyone see how he had turned these Westerners, all these us low-class Westerners, and he had turned us into Vaishnavas, pure Vaishnavas. And he was very proud of this. So he was eager to do this, and he was very excited to do this. So we got there right on the very first day of Kartik. October 15th it was that year. And Prabhupada arrived at Radha Damodar Temple. His rooms were ready. He stayed in his room. Those of you who have been there, you know it's such a wonderful place Radha Damodar Temple is. And Prabhupada had his sitting room where he slept on one side. Then there was a veranda. And on the other side was his kitchen area, and it's also where he did his translation work. And he would look out that window, and he could see Srila Rupa Goswami's Samadhi. So this is where he sat, and he did the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he would say, getting inspiration from Srila Rupa Goswami. So, Prabhupada mentioned this place. He said, this place, Radha Damodar Temple, he said, his rooms at Radha Damodar Temple, he said, were very special. And he said, these rooms are the very hub of the wheel of the spiritual universe. He said, his rooms at Radha Damodar Temple, he said, were the very center of the spiritual world. He said, because it is from these rooms that this society, this Krishna consciousness movement began. He said, in these rooms. And then he said, by Srila Rupa Goswami. He said, not from him, but by Srila Rupa Goswami. He said, so this place, he said, is the center. He said, the hub of the wheel of the spiritual world. Imagine Prabhupada's rooms at Radha Damodar Temple. So the first place that I was able to go to when I went to India was Radha Damodar Temple and stay in Prabhupada's rooms. And I remember India, of course, was so very different than living in where I'd only lived my whole life in America. And they had the doorways. Well, the doors, the walls were like a foot thick going into Prabhupada's room. But the door, double doors, wooden doors, they were only like 4 foot high, 3.5, 4 foot high. So you would always have to bend down and go into the room. But you would have to bend down and the walls were this thick. So I remember always, you know, Prabhupada would ring his bell and I was always, you know, fly in. And one of the first times rang his bell and I went into the room. So I ducked down, but I didn't realize the wall was this thick, you know. So I ducked down and I lifted my head up and I was right into the wall. And of course Prabhupada saw me, you know, which made it was even more painful. So I went in and I banged my head and I went, and Prabhupada looked at me and went, like that, you know. And he said, that's so you become humble. So I knew there was a reason for those walls and those short doors, and so I became humble. So I banged my head a few more times in that process of learning some humility, coming into Prabhupada's room. See, we had to get very low to go into Prabhupada's rooms. So then there were more surprises. So many things happened in that month. It was just, you know, being there at Radha Damodar Temple is just amazing. And, you know, I was so young and had no appreciation or realization of where I was and who I was with. Srila Prabhupada, being with Prabhupada at this place, that was the most amazing thing. And now I had been with Prabhupada for 1 month, and I told you, he taught me how to use his cooker. Now for that whole month, every day I would cook for Prabhupada, using his cooker while giving him massage. So now we got to Vrindavan, and you know, I just assumed everything was going to continue in that way. But I didn't realize in Vrindavan, Jamuna was there. And Jamuna, everyone knows Jamuna. She's put out all the cookbooks, and Prabhupada taught her how to cook. Prabhupada's sister, you know, was with her for a few months, teaching her how to cook Bengali, and she's just amazing. And so when I got to India, I found out that I no longer had to cook, because in India, everybody knew how to cook. The Malati was there, and Jamuna was there, and Palika was there, and Prabhupada had trained them all, or they trained each other how to cook. So in America, no one knew how to cook. You know, in the temples, there were different standards in the temples that were going on. There was, you know, what Prabhupada did in the early days, and then there was what filtered down as years went by. It was like in Los Angeles, they had a chapati rolling machine. You know, there was no such thing as a chapati rolling, but there was this machine that rolled out these oblong things. Because there were so many devotees in the temple, so instead of just considering it okay for someone to roll chapatis all day, that wasn't possible. They had to get a machine. So it turned out these nasty things that they would throw on the stove, and, you know, they wouldn't puff up. I mean, Prabhupada would never eat such a thing. But this was going on. But in India, there were people that were very good cooks. So I didn't have to cook for Prabhupada. And that was okay, because it was, for me, it was a little anxiety at the time. But it was the very first day we were there in Vrindavan, Radha Damodar. So I gave Prabhupada his massage. And then instead of going back into my room and taking the cooker apart and chaunching vegetables and rolling chapatis and making his plate, I was finished. So I just went and I sat on the veranda. I was chanting. It was Vrindavan. And I started chanting japa. And I'm kind of looking in the one room, and Prabhupada's dressed. And then after his massage, he would always take bath. And then he would put fresh cloth on, and he would put fresh tilak on his body. And then he would say his gayatri, his noon gayatri. And he finished gayatri, and then he walked past me, offered obeisances, and he went in through those other little doors, which was in his kitchen, which I hadn't even really seen. We had just gotten there. And he went in, and the screen doors closed, and I saw Jamuna sitting on the floor, you know, with this bucket. That was the stove. It was a bucket stove, and just doing things and rolling chapatis. And Prabhupada went in and sat down right in that same seat where he had sat down from 1960 to 1965 doing his translation work, looking right out that window at Srila Rupa Goswami Samadhi. And I'm just sitting there chanting. And I didn't know what to do with myself, because this was my busiest time of the day, and all of a sudden I had nothing to do. So I just got up and I walked over to the door, because I wanted to see what was going on behind the door. So I walked over and I opened the door and I looked inside, and it was just a small room, very small room, kind of dark. And Prabhupada was sitting right there at that spot where we could look out the window. And I looked in, and there he was taking prasadam. So I just said, oh. And he looked at me and he said, have you taken prasadam? And I said, no, Prabhupada. I said, after you're finished, I said, I'll take with the other devotees. And he said, no. He said, come, take prasadam. And I said, no, Prabhupada, I said, that's all right. I said, I'll take with the other devotees. I said, after you're finished, no one ever took prasadam as Prabhupada. I was with him 2.5 years. Prabhupada sat alone and ate prasadam. So he said, no, no. He said, come, sit down, take prasadam. So I said, yes, Prabhupada. So I went into his room, his kitchen, and I sat down right beside him there at Radha Damodar Temple. Prabhupada had a thali in front of him, nice thali. And immediately Jamuna, she just prepared a thali. She was very efficient. And she made me a thali and put it down in front of me. And Prabhupada and I were taking prasadam together. It's the only time, other than going to these big programs, that I sat with Prabhupada and I got to take prasadam with him. And it was right there in the very center of the spiritual world. I had no idea. I was just looking at the prasadam. And I put my hand in, of course, and took some sabji, you know, and then some dal, and everything tasted so good, you know. And I realized I didn't know what I was doing at all. Even though I was cooking for Prabhupada every day, I thought, oh, this is, you know, this was a whole different standard that I hadn't tasted so far in 2 years. A year and a half in ISKCON, I never tasted anything that was so good. So there we were, sitting together, taking prasadam. Srila Prabhupada and myself, he was so kind that he let me do it that day. On the very first day of Kartik, in 1972, so we're taking prasadam, and I don't, you know, we didn't talk, and I was just eating, and Prabhupada was eating, and she's rolling japatis one at a time, cooking them on cow dung, right there in Vrindavan, and bringing them to us, and we ate for another 15 minutes or so, and then finally I was finishing, and Prabhupada was finishing, and he looked at me, and he smiled. He said, so, he said, did you like? And I said, oh yes, Prabhupada, very much. He said, very good. He said, so tomorrow, he said, you cook for her. I said, yes, Prabhupada. Because he would say, we don't accept service from others and devotees, Vaishnava. We don't want to accept service. And he would say, we call one another Prabhu. And we called everybody Prabhus. There was no problem here. They have, you know, they made a feminine noun for Prabhu for the women, or they just called them Matajis, which came along as well later on. But Prabhupada would also address sometimes his disciples, male and female disciples. He would call them Prabhu sometimes. Like he would say Jamuna Prabhu or Palika Prabhu. He was calling us Prabhu, and we were his disciples. So he would say, you dress one another as Prabhu. He said, what is the question? He said, did you accept service? Prabhu means master, right? It's a very formal expression. In India, it's not used mostly at all. You don't call anyone Prabhu. It's reserved for most formal. But Prabhupada instituted that in ISKCON to show just how much respect we have for one another. He said, so what's the question? He said, of accepting service. Like, Prabhu, will you please get me? That's what we do, right? Prabhu, will you go get me my beads? Or Prabhu, get me this. You know, you're calling your master and then you're telling him what to do for you. So he said that. He said, tomorrow you cook for her. And that didn't come because when she wouldn't allow me in the kitchen even to do any cooking. Neither would she have appreciated what I cooked for her like I appreciated what she cooked for me. But I did get to see that there were different standards. And I cooked nice. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he liked what I cooked very much. And once in Mayapur, after he got some of Prabhupada's remnants, you know, which I cooked at that time, I was cooking. He came into the room and he said, oh, Prabhupada, he said, Shruta Kirti, he's a very good cook. And Prabhupada said, oh yes, he said, he cooks nice American prasadam. So yeah, Prabhupada didn't let us get compliments very much. He always put things into reality. So he complimented me, he said, but I cook very nice American prasadam. But then, when Harisari was with him, see, Harisari was with him, and sure, if he was there, he would tell. Harisari couldn't cook at all for Prabhupada. He tried once or twice, like Satsrup Maharaj. They couldn't even figure out how to use the cooker. And they just kind of gave up. And once Harisari, he was driving Juhu going from Prabhupada's place to the temple. He had some problem with the car. And Prabhupada said to him, Shrutakirti can drive. He said, and Shrutakirti can cook. And Shrutakirti can type. Because Harisari couldn't type, he couldn't. So Prabhupada always let us know we had things to work on, you know. But he would do it in a very humorous way sometimes. So I didn't even. So let me see. It's 8:15. What? 7:15. Oh, it's early, huh? Yeah.
Is it early?
Okay. So what should I? What
should I? The monkey story.
The monkey story. Okay. This is for the children and all of us. And this also, imagine now, Radha Damodar Temple, which is right in the heart of Seva Kunj, which is right in the heart of monkey land in Vrindavan. And this was my first. Now, you know, we're all very familiar with monkeys and what they do and how they act and how mischievous they are. But I had no idea what monkeys were like. I was just seeing them. As Prabhupada would speak, because he would start to speak in the evening just as the sun was going down. And that's a very active time for animals in general, you know, they're getting back to where they spend their nights. So you would see parrots flying in pairs of pretty green parrots in Vrindavan, and you would hear the peacocks and the monkeys running. It was just like Vrindavan, you know, it was just right out of Krishna book. It was just amazing to be in Vrindavan, see all these things, to see the asses carrying big loads on their back, and the hogs were there. It was just like everything we had heard about in Prabhupada's books and in Bhagavad Gita was all existing there. So one day, and Prabhupada, while he was there for a month, he moved up to the second floor above his room. There was another large room up there, and he had to stay there because they were painting his room. So from that room, there was like a big veranda, which was just the roof of the first floor. In India, it was all concrete, so it was just a nice smooth roof. So Prabhupada stayed up there for a week or so, and I would literally put the bucket out. Prabhupada would use just one bucket of water to bathe after his massage. And he said, you can just put it out in the sun, and the sun would warm it up a bit. One of the things after Prabhupada had his heart attack was the doctor said, no cold water, because it would be very dangerous for you. So Prabhupada took that very seriously. But he said, you don't have to heat the water. He said, just leave it out, and the sun will heat it naturally. And sometimes the monkeys, they would, you know, be drinking the water. Prabhupada didn't care. You know, he would drink the water and all. But he would just use the one bucket. So he would take massage out there on the veranda, and then he would bathe right there in his gumshoe with the lota. Even wherever he went, if he was in Los Angeles, if he was at the manor, then his beautiful bathroom, big gigantic tub. And in America, you know, everywhere there are showers and tubs. And Prabhupada had a bucket in the bathtub. And you just fill the bucket up and get your lota and bathe. Because that's how you're supposed to bathe. That's the best way. So, and you use, of course, a minimal amount of water, because we don't waste anything. So wherever we went was always, that's what I said, it was so the same everywhere we went. It didn't matter if everything was like a palace. Prabhupada had a bucket and had a lota, and he would take massage on a straw mat that I carried with us in his suitcase. We had a folding one, you know, the sides would fold over, you would roll it up. So we had the straw mat, 10 rupee mat, you know, or 5 rupee gumchas, and that's how things went on. You know, I had a little bottle of mustard oil for massage, and for his head, sandalwood oil. That was the even then sandalwood oil was expensive. Now it's like, you know, more than gold, huh? And it's by weight. It's so expensive. But he would use sandalwood oil on his head. So after bathing one day, Prabhupada went into his room, he went into his bedroom. So after Prabhupada bathed, and before I would give a massage, I would lay his clothes out for after his bath. So he would have copan, you know, the two pieces of copan, and I would put a dhoti down and his kurta like that, and I would just lay it out on the bed. So he would come in and he would just drop his towel and, you know, put his dhoti around him and get dressed. And then he would go into his sitting room, and he would sit down, and he would put his tilak on, and sit up very straight and say, Gayatri. So Prabhupada was in his room there, and I was out on the veranda, so I was cleaning up and folded up the mat and everything. And I opened Prabhupada's door to go into the room, to go into his bedroom, to get his towel and everything. And I offered obeisances, and I sat up. And when I sat up, Prabhupada was sitting there, like, you know, he grabbed a piece of tilak, his ball. Prabhupada had a ball of tilak that he would use to put on, you know, his forehead. And it was the size of a golf ball. So as I was getting up, he was grabbing the tilak and threw it right at me. And I just, I mean, he just, like a baseball pictures, and it was, boom, I got real fast, right by my, it just missed my head, and I was, didn't know what I had done. And he said, monkey, monkey, and here I left the door open when I went into the room. I didn't close the door behind me, and in that instant, a monkey came into the room, and it took one of Prabhupada's sandals. So Prabhupada was trying to hit the monkey with the tilak, so he would drop the sandal, but, monkeys are very, Prabhupada said they have mystic cities. He said you couldn't, he would say you cannot do that so fast. Like within a few seconds, a monkey can steal a bunch of bananas. He said you can't do that. So for you, that's mystical. He said he would play down these, you know, mystical. See, mystical means I can do something you can't. Then for you, that's mystical. He said, so monkeys, they have mystic powers, he said. So immediately Prabhupada got up and he said, come on. So now this was my first experience with monkeys. And then now Prabhupada's already saying, now these monkeys, he said, rascals, you know. He said, these monkeys are such rascals. And we walked out the door. And Prabhupada knew just what was going on. And as soon as we walked out the door, Prabhupada looked up above the door. And the ceiling wasn't so high there, you know, maybe 8 foot or something, a little less. So, and right above us, over the doorway, is the monkey. And he's holding Prabhupada's sandal. It was a little plastic tan sandal, crisscross. And he's just holding it there. And Prabhupada said, hi, Prabhupada's just yelling. And he's like, you know, rascal, he said, you know. He said, come on, he said, we have to get this sandal. And he said, try to get the sandal. So Prabhupada's standing there, now he just has his dhoti on, he just put his tilak on, and just bathed, and he's standing, and he said, try to get it, because I was taller, so I'm trying to reach up, and the monkey is just playing games, he knows exactly what he's doing all the time, he's completely in control, and it's just this thing, it's like this big, and you know, these funny faces, you know, and I would reach up, and whenever I would reach up, he would just keep it just out of reach, so Prabhupada gets his cane and swings his rascal monkey, you know, he keeps calling him. They're so mischievous, he said, they don't leave anyone alone, why don't they just, you know. And I'm like thinking it was like complete ecstasy, you know, I was in ecstasy next to Prabhupada with this monkey in Vrindavan. And he just got the sandal. And Prabhupada said, okay, he said, get some sweets. Because in Prabhupada's room, there was a jar of sweets. There was always a jar of sweets in Prabhupada's room, because you could never leave Prabhupada's room without getting prasadam. That's Vaishnavism. So he said, get some sweets. So I went into Prabhupada's room and I grabbed three sweets. They were parrot, just a very hard milk sweet. So I grabbed them. And Prabhupada looked. He said, okay. He said, try to trade. for the sandal. So he was explaining to me what you do here in Vrindavan. So I said, yes, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada's just looking and he says, and the monkey is just having so much fun. You know, that's what they do, that's why they're monkeys. And now he's holding the sandal in his mouth. He's not just holding it, but like he put it in his mouth and he's gone, you know. And then he put it back down. So he's just annoying. You know, he's just completely annoying us. And Prabhupada said, try to get the sandal. So now I have a sweet in my hand, you know. And the monkey knows. This is what the monkey wants, is to get food from you. That's their only aim, is to get food. So I'm putting the sweet up. And the monkey's just bent over and he's handing me the sandal. So I'm putting up the sweet, and you know, this is another game, right? This is a keep-away game now that I wasn't so good at. So I'm putting up the sweet, and the monkey's handing me the sandal. So I gave him the sweet, and he pulled the sandal back. And Prabhupada said, demons, Prabhupada. He said, they're demons, you know. And he said, try it again. Now, in the meantime, as this is going on, this monkey's chewing on Prabhupada's sandal, the heel of the sandal, and he's just biting it and chewing on it. He said, Prabhupada, try it again. So I got another sweet. And, you know, now I realize he's not just going to give it away, that he's, you know, he's really being, you know, a rascal, you know. So I start putting the sweet up, and the monkey's like this, and putting it down. So I tried so hard, you know, and I put it up, and I'm reaching up. And I put it up and I reached up and the monkey grabbed the sweet again and he kept the sandal. So three sweets I lost. So after the third sweet, and now the monkey's still chewing on Prabhupada's lotus sandal. And he grabbed the end of it and went, and he ripped the heel off of the sandal. The top of the heel is there. And Prabhupada said, he said, never mind. He said, he's ruined the sandal. Prabhupada was just frustrated with this monkey. He said, never mind. Prabhupada walked into the room. So I just looked up and, you know, I didn't know. And I started to walk away. And as soon as I started to walk away, the monkey put the sandal down. He didn't drop it onto the ground. He actually left it hanging at the edge of the roof so I could see it. You know? And he put it there on the edge, and you just see it sitting there on this roof. And then the monkey disappeared. So, just at that time, this one young boy, just like your age, how old are you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was just about your age. His name was Girish. He was the son of one of the devotees, Shilavati from New Vrindavan. And he was walking down. He was in Vrindavan staying with his father at that time. And as he was walking by, I said, Girish, come here. So he came over. I said, see that sandal? I said, that's Prabhupada's sandal. I said, would you go up and get it for me? Because he could always, whenever there's a roof in India, there's always a stairs to go to that roof. It's never just a wasted space. There's always stairs, because that's another level you can sit on or hang laundry or do whatever, build a house, sleep at night because it's cooler when it's hot out, and so many things. So anyway, Girish goes up and I'm standing watching. So he gets up on the roof and he just walks to the edge and he goes to grab the sandal. And as soon as he goes down, puts his hand down to grab the sandal, a dozen monkeys just appear out of nowhere. They're just like out of the trees. And they all come and just surround them. And these monkeys could be, you know, and they're all making faces and screaming and screeching and showing their teeth. They would show, and, you know, they start like, and Girish, he just starts screaming, Shrutakirti! And he's just surrounded by all these little demoniac monkeys. And Prabhupada's cane was still there. So I just grabbed Prabhupada's cane and I said, Girish, here, and I threw the cane up. So as soon as he had the cane, he just started swishing it around and all the monkeys left. So then Girish came down with the cane in one hand and Prabhupada's sandal in the other hand, He said, here. He was petrified. I thanked him. I didn't give him a sweet or anything, the poor boy. And I took the sandal. I just wanted that sandal so much. It was Prabhupada's sandal, you know. And that little flap was hanging on it that the monkey had ripped. He didn't rip it completely off. It was dangling on the top part of the sandal. So I had Prabhupada's cane and I had the sandal. And I went back into Prabhupada's room and I put the cane against the wall. And I walked up and offered obeisances. And I said, Prabhupada, I said, I have your sandal. And Prabhupada looked. He said, oh, he said, it's not so bad. He said, can you fix it with a little glue? I said, yes, Prabhupada. He said, okay. He said, well, then you fix it. He said, and we can keep it. And so he continued to use those sandals, which had bite marks. So here is the person. He had temples all around the world. His disciples were collecting millions and millions of kroners everywhere around the world. And Prabhupada was just going to keep those sandals. And he continued to use them in Vrindavan. He would go on, I glued it back on. And you could see all the teeth marks, piercing marks from the monkey's teeth in the sandal. And I never even said anything. I was so dull-headed. Because Prabhupada never said, tell someone to get me sandals. Imagine all the money that was being spent in our society, flying around doing so many things. Prabhupada never asked for anything for himself. It was up to me to figure it out, but I was so dull-headed and so just used to how Prabhupada did things, I didn't even think of it for some time. So we just wore those sandals in Vrindavan for the rest of the month, and then after he left Vrindavan, he went to Hyderabad. And in Hyderabad, he stayed. At that time, his name was Mr. Pitti. Panayalal Pitti. He had the biggest house in all of Hyderabad. He was one of the wealthiest people in Hyderabad. And he had this big palatial house and big gardens. And there was all kinds of quarters in the back, guest quarters and servant quarters. And there was garages for like 20 cars. He had all these different cars. And he had American cars in there. And, you know, Indian cars. Cars from all over the world. He was a very well-to-do man. So Prabhupada went and stayed there for a few days. We were having a pandal there. And as soon as we arrived, he said to me, does your, you know, does Swamiji need anything? And finally, something went off in my head. I said, okay. I said, he could use a new pair of sandals. He said, no problem. You know, sandals, like, what, they cost 10 rupees or something. He said, yes, no problem. So he sent one of his servants out. And he came back with a box of sandals. And so I went right into Prabhupada's room and I said, Prabhupada, I said, I was so happy, you know, I finally figured out to get Prabhupada some nice shoes. So I said, Prabhupada, I said, they got your sandals. And Prabhupada said, oh, very good. So he opened the box and they were leather. And Prabhupada said, I cannot wear these. He said, I said, yes, Prabhupada. We'll close the box. So finally, I got Prabhupada some proper sandals. I just realized that I had to get him some new slippers. You know, he was entitled to a pair that weren't chewed by monkeys. And those slippers were given to Kirti Raj. Some of you might have heard of Kirti Raj. Actually, he did a lot of preaching in Poland back in the 80s and all, and it was still very Sweden. Yeah. And also behind, in communist countries when it was very difficult. So he has those slippers in his house on his altar in a glass case, just still there, and you can still see the little teeth marks in there and everything. A very special pair of slippers that he would never part with. So that was the monkeys. And one of the monkey stories in Vrindavan. They were always around harassing, but that was just so pleasant to be with Prabhupada. In all these situations there at Radha Damodar Temple. So, yes, welcome. So, have any questions this evening?
I have one.
Yes, sir.
I'm very inquisitive to know. Mm-hmm. I've been to Vrindavan many times. By the side of the Damodar Temple is the Radha Shamasundar Temple. Oh, Radharani's temple. Just by the side, it's hardly 100 meters, 200 meters. I've seen the picture with Radha Shamsundra Tirthu, Prabhupada's picture, with earthy type. Prabhupada was seeing, and sometimes was even, maybe it was crying also, when the earthy type was Radha Shamsundra. And then, that temple was, that when I hear that Prabhupada used to come there every day, every evening or every day, I do not know, because that was before my time. Is it true?
It was before my time. I don't. No, I mean from the time I was with Prabhupada, of course, in 1972, he stayed at Radha Damodar.
Yeah.
And then the next time I was with Prabhupada, they had already, building was going on at Krishna Balaram Mandir. So one of the first things, they built the guest house, and as they were building the temple, they built Prabhupada's quarters. And they weren't even finished yet, but they were finished enough for Prabhupada to live in. So then at that time he stayed in his quarters. And once or twice while I was with Prabhupada in Vrindavan, once he went to Govardhan, I remember we drove to Govardhan by car, and I didn't know where I was when I was with Prabhupada, because I was with Prabhupada, that's all I knew. And we got there and we got out, and Prabhupada took darshan at Govardhan Hill. And another time he visited a few of the temples in Vrindavan, in the town of Vrindavan. But that was just, when I was with him, that was the only time, other than going around on his morning walk, where Prabhupada set out to see a temple in Vrindavan. He would always stay the temple he had established. And of course, Radha Damodar, when we first got there in 72, for Kartik, I remember arriving, and it was late in the morning, I guess, maybe 10 o'clock in the morning or so, mid-morning. And at that time, it was the grandfather of present Goswami there. His name was Gurachan Goswami. He was the temple, charge of the temple there, Gurachan Goswami. And he was a funny man. Among other things, he had different habits, but he had these glasses. He was almost blind, when he had these very thick glasses, I remember. But he was very friendly to Prabhupada. And when Prabhupada came in, there was a big, kind of like a big festival almost, and they brought Prabhupada right up to the deity doors, which were closed. And then they opened the doors, and Prabhupada got darshan, Radha Damodar. And they were ringing the bell. That's when I heard, that was the first time I was ringing. We didn't have bells at that time in any of our centers, but they were banging the bell and the gong, to no apparent melody or tune, they would just bang it. And Prabhupada offered obeisances, we all offered obeisances. And then they closed the doors, and we're standing there. And then they opened the doors again, and they had Krishna's footprint. It was just one big stone. It was like this big, I remember. He said it was Krishna's footprint from Govardhan. And then Prabhupada said, if you just circumambulate this, and it's just like going around all of Govardhan, which if you go around all of Govardhan, it's a lot more difficult than going around Radha Damodar, Parikrama. So we would do that every day, of course, because Krishna's footprint. Giriraj was there, so we would do our circumambulation there in Radha Damodar temple. Prabhupada liked it, of course, that place very much, and he said to keep his rooms there, always to keep his rooms there very nicely. Yeah.
Here in the West, when we get angry at somebody, we chastise them, especially if we're in the position of management. It's usually out of frustration or anger at the person who didn't come up to our standard. But when Prabhupada chastised a person, what was his motive? What was he thinking when he chastised the person?
Well, he would see it so many times. Prabhupada would say it was his duty to chastise the disciple. One thing was, accepting a disciple. Prabhupada said, for one to become disciple, What do you do? What's the main thing we have to do when we become disciple? It's to learn how to become humble. You have to be humble to accept the spiritual master. In fact, once someone said to Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya doesn't say anything about accepting a spiritual master, right? And Prabhupada's response was, yes, he does. Right? In Shashastakam, he says, as soon as he says, humbler than a blade of grass, he says, that means to accept the spiritual master. You have to become humble. So, from what I saw for the, many times, when Prabhupada would chastise us, it was to help us become humble, because we would become puffed up. It's very easy to become puffed up in our service and think we're doing so much. Actually, we were never doing anything. It was always Prabhupada's desire, Prabhupada's potency, that anything was going on in his kind. You can just see what happened when Prabhupada was present. And after Prabhupada left, how difficult it was after Prabhupada's leaving. So there was never any material, jealousy, like she said so nicely yesterday, that when Prabhupada said, what's the difference between here and the spiritual world, is there's no envy in the spiritual world. That's why we have to be so careful when we have something to say about someone else, what is, what's really inside. And sometimes we don't even see it ourselves, what could be so obvious. So again, Prabhupada was always to encourage. I'll tell in the next couple of days as well, different times he chastised me or those that were around me. Prabhupada was always, he didn't want to see us fall from Krishna consciousness. So to chastise him, because he knew if we were following a certain path, we were going to fall away. So, he never wanted to see that happen. That was Prabhupada, that was his biggest hurt, was seeing someone leave his shelter. The shelter of the society, the shelter of him, Krishna. So he would, at the back of this book I have one letter. It's so nice. I'll read it just since you asked the question. Because I say it's my favorite letter. And there's many things in it, but I'll just tell you this one part in it right now. If I can find it. Ah, here it is. This was written December 14th, 1972. It's to his disciple, Tushita Krishna. And again, he says, I'm in due receipt of your letters dated November 18th, November 22nd, and December 3rd. So in all these letters, he asked questions. So now, as I said, Prabhupada always answered the questions of his disciples. So now three letters and there's questions. But in here he says, I heard that you were having some difficulties. So I have sent Siddha Sarup there to help you. Now try to keep a cool head under all circumstances and always remember that Krishna will protect you in any case. You haven't to worry anything. Now he was the president of the temple in New Zealand, Auckland Temple, Tushita Krishna. So he says, I think that without you, the New Zealand affair will not go on. So he's saying, if you leave this temple, it's going to fall apart. He says, but now you are leaving there to live on some farm in Australia. Of course, our serving Krishna is a voluntary affair, so what can I say? If you think that is the best choice, I must agree, otherwise you might go away altogether. Anyway, we shall discuss it in detail if I come there in the future. So he was asking Prabhupada's permission to leave his service as president in New Zealand and go live on a farm in Australia. So Prabhupada said he must agree. Prabhupada said, didn't say no, you have to stay, because he knew he was going to leave. So Prabhupada was so careful in his dealings that even if we were about to do something he didn't want us to do, he wouldn't say, don't do this. He would say, the process is voluntary, you do what you think is best, because he wouldn't let us make an offense. So in his chest, there was no question of chastising just for the sake of you or annoying him or something. Everything he did was so that you could make advancement in Krishna consciousness. So even when there was some possibility of offending, this was offensive for a disciple. Now Prabhupada, it's obvious Prabhupada wants him to stay. But he said, you do what you think is best. And he said, we'll discuss it later on. So because, and that's how he felt, he must agree, because he wouldn't let us make an offense. I was with Prabhupada 2.5 years, and I had, there were a few times I asked Prabhupada a question. Most of them were just simple, innocent questions. But there was one time I asked Prabhupada a question because I didn't understand something that Prabhupada said. I kind of did, but I just needed to hear Prabhupada say something. And it was in, it was 1975 or 1973. Anyway, Prabhupada, while I was massaging Prabhupada, he would sometimes get letters from his disciples, and the secretary would read them, and then Prabhupada would dictate a response. So he was, cooking was going on, Prabhupada's getting a massage, and he's doing his mail. All this is going on at the same time. It was a very busy time. And this secretary read this letter, and this devotee boy was asking Prabhupada, one of his disciples, if he could get a divorce, because he wanted to get remarried. And Prabhupada said yes. And when he said it, now I'm massaging Prabhupada, and I'm sitting behind him, and I just couldn't believe Prabhupada said that, you know. And I didn't say anything. Who am I saying? But it just, I just kept hearing that letter and Prabhupada's response all day long in my head, you know. And I just want to ask Prabhupada. And I was always I always picked my moments, you know. So the whole day went by, and now it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm with Prabhupada in his room, his bedroom, alone, and I'm massaging his legs again, and massaging his feet. And I thought about this all day, and I'm thinking, that's just not the answer Prabhupada ever gave. I mean, look in Prabhupada's books, he never condones this. And I knew that. And I'm massaging him, and Prabhupada just lying there completely relaxed. It was the best time of the day, just giving Prabhupada a massage at night. No one else was ever around, no one to ask questions or except me. And of course, I never did. But I'm rubbing his feet, and I said, it was really hard for me because I just didn't like to do it. You know. And I said, Prabhupada, and he just like opened his eyes. And I said, you remember today? I said, that letter you got from your disciple. And I said, he asked you if it was okay to get a divorce. And before I could say anything else, Prabhupada said, oh yes, he said, I told him it was okay. And that made it even. I said, yes, Prabhupada. I said, I don't understand. I said, Prabhupada, you always preach in Vedic society and divorce is not, you know, not possible, not allowed. And he said, yes, he said. But he said, in your culture, he said, these things are going on. And he said, it's just like that. And I said, yes, Prabhupada. And I was a wise guy. And I said, but so is meat eating and intoxication and gambling. I said, but, you know, I said, we don't allow any of these things. And then Prabhupada looked at me. He said, yes. He said, whether I told him it was okay or not, he said he was going to get a divorce. He said, so if I tell him it's okay, he said, then the offense is not so great. He said, so I told him it was okay. So then everything I already knew, and I thought, how could I have had any doubts how Prabhupada was dealing with individuals? So this is how Prabhupada deals with us. This is how he dealt with us. He would go out of his way to see that we didn't commit an offense in our devotional service. And it was exactly what he said. He knew, Prabhupada knew what we were going to do. And he would deal with us accordingly, which wasn't what was always written, in Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, when Prabhupada was on the Vyasasan delivering the absolute truth, which was there. But then when he was dealing with his disciples, when he was dealing with people, he would deal with them understanding what was required, how to help them in their Krishna consciousness, and he would do that. So that requires purity as a Vaishnava. It requires, Prabhupada would say, a little intelligence. So Prabhupada always knew how he had to deal with this. But then you would never see Prabhupada write that, yes, this is okay. But as soon as he was faced with the situation, he would do whatever was necessary to help that person in their Krishna consciousness. Yes?
Prabhu, you mentioned that Srila Prabhupada said that oil is only for external use. So my question is, did Srila Prabhupada take salad, and if he did he take, what did he use for it? Did Srila Prabhupada take salad?
Salad?
Salad.
No, he didn't. He took writers.
Yeah. Not even in the West.
No. I mean, you know, sometimes people would put, I remember in Hawaii, once he went to the restaurant in Hawaii, and they brought him a salad with sprouts on it, and, you know, Prabhupada took it. But it's not what he liked. Yeah. Yes?
Would it be, is cooking for deities sometimes, sunseed oil and corn oil is not okay to use for cooking and offer for the deities? Is it not accepted at all?
No.
No. But is it, there's a Pujaya courses where they say that this kind of two oil, corn oil and sunseed oil, it is Vijayapura Swami that's given this. He said it can be accepted.
Who's that?
Bhakti Vijayapura Swami, he says.
That's new to me.
I'm yeah. Hey, there's a letter somewhere where Prabhupada says if nothing else is available or something, you know. But, you know, if nothing else is available, you can eat meat as well. So if you want to take, you know, it's available everywhere. Hey, there's so many reasons. I mean, they go, oil, you can't reheat oil. It becomes carcinogenic. It's carcinogenic means eventually it can cause cancer. Oil, you can reheat ghee forever. You can just keep adding more ghee and reheat. So it's just not healthy.
But ghee is the animal fat. The animal fat does consist certain chemical contents.
When you cook down the butter, The
impurities.
The impurities come to the top.
Yeah.
So you only have the pure form. He is very pure, and they actually, even with the older it gets, the purer it gets. And you can reheat it and reheat it, and it's always healthy.
But still, is that human fat?
Milk is animal fat.
Yeah,
yes.
That is what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Chemical is scientific. I'm talking about not the religious
part. Well, that's not bad.
No, I'm not saying
that.
I'm talking about that it is a cat. Yeah,
this
comes from the milk.
Comes from the milk.
And that is also the same way if you heat it up, right? That is the constituency, the molecules of the oil or the ghee.
Yeah.
The chemical, if you taste that.
Oh, it's not the same.
It's not the same. Scientifically, it's proven it's not the same. If you study Ayurveda, it will tell you it's not the same.
I had a friend who is a chemical engineer. He told me about that. These are the things.
You read the Ayurveda, that's from Krishna as well.
No, that's all that I agree. But I do not know scientifically that they can have that. That is exactly that. What is the fact of what?
Yes, Matthew.
I was just wondering that I was in Vrindavan in January and this. This Prabhupada's quarters in Radha Damodara temple is temporarily closed. I do not know the details. And in Radha Damodara temple is Vasila Prabhupada's rooms.
Yeah, and I mean, they definitely did get locked up last year, and there's been a court battle going on that I know of, and they were reopened but ISKCON does not have control of them as far as I know at the present time, but they're open for darshan, for the devotees to go in and take darshan of Srila Prabhupada, but it's certainly a regrettable situation with currently going on, I think. Is what happened was they were closed by the devotee because they were refurbishing, they were fixing them, but it went on for months and months and months, And is what happened was they stopped living inside Prabhupada's rooms. It would always, someone would stay there, which in India is a very important thing. You know, possession is everything, and 90% of the laws would be possession. So because they were doing these repairs, they, for some reason, they weren't staying there. And while no one was staying there, the Goswami there locked the doors. And then since then, there's been a big battle, but some progress has been made, but I currently am not sure, and I haven't seen anything written lately about it, so I don't know what's going on. As I know, every day they're open for a certain time, but it's not because of us being there in charge, it's God being in charge.
It was just that also in the temple, in Krishna Bharavan temple, then the Prabhupada's rooms also there is kind of neglected, like curtains. I mean, I don't want to create such a sweet evening, but I just wanted to ask this question, like, you hear so much, like, put Prabhupada back in the center, something like, if you could say a few words, like, about that.
I mean, yes, it's that, you know, that's what I try to do in all my traveling, is traveling and preaching, which, you know, sometimes can also be difficult traveling around, but it is to try to keep Prabhupada consciousness there, because he is Prabhupada, you know, ISKCON, as Prabhupada said, is his body, and this society is Srila Prabhupada's. And it's important to always remember that everything belongs to him. And just as I was telling that story about Prabhupada's slipper, you know, which is a very sweet story, but it also shows how Prabhupada was, that he didn't take anything, he didn't consider anything to be his. You know, and he was, whatever Krishna provided, that was okay. His business was always preaching. And this is, you know, how ISKCON was established for this purpose. And like he said, otherwise, just, you know, to have temples for people to live comfortably. And here it is not, you know, not so comfortable here. But see, we have some very big centers in our society in different countries, especially now in India. We have some of the biggest temples. And you know, we get these positions, you know, where we can have our offices and our internet and our rooms and our telephones and all these things, but and salaries going on. But I mean, Prabhupada's mood was never like this. You know, he wanted preachers, and as I was saying yesterday, we were so renounced, you know, in this kind of the early days. But this society is there, and now it's up to us, all of us, to try to follow Prabhupada's instructions. And, you know, when you come in any temple, what is the first thing you see? You see Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasana. So whose place is it, you know? I mean, we're just all servants to Srila Prabhupada. And the more we realize that everything is happening by his mercy, and the more we think like that, and the more we do our service like that, then the more progress can be made. In this book I was reading about Mayapur, Prabhupada says over and over again, if you just try to follow in the footsteps of the acharyas and follow their instructions and don't change anything, you'll get all the blessings of Lord Chaitanya. Anything could happen. He says this whole Vedic planetarian city, everything will happen if we follow. So we can, you know, Prabhupada would say you judge a thing by the results. So, but it's all individually. We all have to individually do that and set an example, and that's all anyone can do. Might go on to add something.
I think your point is so important, and that's regarding the rooms. Prabhupada specifically instructed the devotees when he was on the planet to never leave those rooms empty for one moment. And they left them empty for, I think, like six weeks. Because he knew, you know, he knew what would happen. And as soon as they left them empty, I felt very bad, very, very sad about that situation. I felt it was a very bad omen
Was your with Prabhupada right to be in this world?
No. I was a servant until July of 1975. Then Hari Sari came after that. And he's done so many books. He kept diary and done a lot of writings. He came a few months after that. He was with him for just over a year. And then, of course, he was in Vrindavan for the last several months. Where, you know, then he had attention from many devotees and secretaries and servants. I was in Hawaii at that time. I was the temple president in the Hawaii temple. And I went to see him in August of 1977. And I was there for a few weeks. But then I went back to my duties. We just didn't think, you know, just always thought Prabhupada would stay again. And information coming later on in October and November was not very complete. So, you know, for many of us, we just didn't realize Prabhupada was going to be leaving, because he wanted all his disciples to come. He wanted to be surrounded by so many disciples. But, yes?
Firstly, thank you very much for giving a very nice discourse. Especially, I must say that every time we visit Radhakrishna Tradition room of Srila Prabhupada, and also Manor, there is no doubt in our minds, I'm speaking both for myself and my wife, the presence of Srila Prabhupada is there. I mean, last time we were in Manor, we took a guest of ours who had never been to ISKCON.
Yeah.
That lady, she's a doctor, and we took her to the room upstairs in Manor. She said, but he is there.
Yeah.
You know, the first, there was a first reaction.
Yeah.
Saying that he is there.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, he is there. But my question is, I would just say that yes, he is everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially in these two places, his presence is, I mean, it's phenomenal.
We agree, yes.
My question is from yesterday, when you said that you're in the LA garden, you were reading some that Krishna stories for
Krishna
him,
book, yes.
About the demoniac, and suddenly you found that Srila Prabhupada, he was laughing and he was in the ecstasy. Mm-hmm. My question is, when he was in that particular ecstasy, when his eyes closed and he was in a different platform, how do you feel?
Well, there were different, you know, that was more about just a happy, humorous kind of ecstasy. I saw Prabhupada in ecstasy on the Vyasasan a few times, where he would close his eyes, he would stop class. Usually he would stop speaking because of emotion, where he would be crying, almost weeping, and then he would just close his eyes, and we would just sit there. Sometimes there would be 200 devotees in the temple room, and we would just sit there and not make a sound and just look at Prabhupada. And then finally, it seemed like, you know, a few minutes, like a few years, and then he would just open his eyes and he would say, chant Hare Krishna, and that would be it. So I don't, you know, I don't understand or know. We all felt ourselves at those times, we would become quite overwhelmed and with ecstatic feelings, but you know, I don't know what Prabhupada was always in ecstasy. Krishna was always, this pure devotee sees Krishna in his heart at every moment. And you know, Vaishnavas, they contain their ecstasy. They, you know, they never, Prabhupada would never exhibit it consciously, and when it did happen, that's what he would do, but he would just close his eyes. And that's why I said I enjoyed the laughing state, because that's something you could see, you know, that sweetness that Prabhupada had. But these other times were also, you know, very wonderful. And, you know, as time went by, I think more and more Prabhupada's emotions were coming out as years went by. It become more difficult to control even. And that's, you know, I think that's also part of his leaving, was like that. I mean, he was exhibiting ecstatic symptoms all the time. You know, you could look on one level and you might think that he was infirm, that he was ill, but actually there was all kinds of ecstatic emotions were there in his body. So, and that's what really was going on.
That's why you mentioned the manor.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's my favorite Prabhupada Murti upstairs in the manor.
We took some guests about a month ago. One of a friend of ours left his body and the family came. And we took them up into the manor, into the room. And it actually literally took 5 minutes to realize it was a Murti. They actually thought he was sitting there. And then we said, no, it's a deity.
Yeah.
He was there.
People think he's so very present. You know, very present.
Really is.
So that's the thing. Prabhupada is present and he is watching. And that's why we have to ourselves be pure, follow Prabhupada's instructions, and have confidence that Prabhupada's in charge. Now, this is what my friend Ambri said to me the other day over something, and I mentioned that already last night, that he said, Prabhupada is boiling the milk, he said. That's what we would always say. And he said, and, you know, those that don't rise, he said, get cooked in the juice. So sometimes things take time, but everything will be corrected, you know, as part of Krishna's plan. Sometimes, I mean, just look, you know, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, he was here. He left in 1935. And what did Prabhupada say about what was going on in the Gaudiya Math? They were just sitting in the temples and, you know, collecting their donation. There was no big... He always wanted preachers, preaching. He always talked about preaching. But it was 30 years later that Prabhupada went to America. It wasn't 2 years later that everything carried on such a big, wonderful way, according to his desire, even though he told all of his disciples to preach, go to the West and preach. He gave them so many instructions for preaching. But it was 30 years later that Prabhupada went to America. And then Prabhupada was in America for a year, from 1965, going here, you know, went to Pennsylvania, went to New York, and he lived in one spot, and he lived in another spot. It wasn't for several months later that his first disciples came from Tompkins Square Park. So, you know, like someone said about Ajamil, Prabhupada, you know, it took him 80 years from the time when he had difficulty, and he fell down. It was 80 years later when he became Krishna conscious. And Prabhupada said, what's 80 years? We should be so fortunate. You know, we should have that fortune. We can become Krishna conscious in this lifetime, in 80 lifetimes. What's 80 years? We've been floating around since time immemorial. And to think that everything is just going to be wonderful, that's the wrong understanding. This place is never wonderful. Right? What is it called? Mrityaloka. It's a place of death. Everyone here... Prabhupada would say something. See, that's what he would say when Prabhupada would talk from that absolute platform. That would be so heavy. When you were in his room and you were with him privately, there was this sweetness and wonderful. But, you know, he would say, just like, you know, if you're 25 years old, it means you're 25 years dead. You know, he would say, you're dying for 25 years. From the moment you're born, what are we doing? We're dying. And that's the place where we're living. So our business is just pack up and get out of here. Follow Prabhupada's instructions, chant 16 rounds, follow the regulative principles, and just surrender to Prabhupada, you know, surrender to Krishna. Otherwise, it's never going to be perfect here. When Prabhupada was here at a society, he was always having to deal with so many difficulties. It wasn't that everything was... Right, everything was perfect because he was here. It was perfect. He was perfect here. But he said, someone once said to Prabhupada, we're all puppets. We're all your puppets. Puppets in your hands. And Prabhupada laughed. He said, yes. He said, but I want you to go like this and you're going like this. That's the way it was. You know, Prabhupada, imagine if we just did what Prabhupada wanted all the time. When he was here, what we could have done. You know, even then, as we were going like this, instead of, it's very subtle, huh? You can't even see the difference unless you look closely. So he's saying we're doing just the opposite of what he's telling us to do, and still Prabhupada opened 100 temples, millions of books were distributed, you know, 80 books were typeset and printed in so many different languages, all these things went on. But even we couldn't follow so well. But because of his potency and his desire, so much happened. So that's what's needed. Pure, I would say, one pure devotee can do so much. And he said they always leave. Just like he said, Bhakti Vinod Thakur. He wanted, right, Mayapur. He wanted from America, he wanted devotees from America and Europe and Indians to come together and chant. Prabhupada said, but he didn't complete that task. He left. He said he left it for us. So Bhakti Sadhanta Saraswati Thakur, he also didn't complete it. So that's their mercy. He said they could have done it. Pure devotee can do anything. He can do anything they want, but they leave something behind so that we have something to do. So that's our business, is to take it up seriously, you know, to service and do something. Otherwise, we shouldn't think that, you know, Prabhupada only did so much, but he should have, or, you know, he could have done everything. But they just do a little. We have something to do. That's their mercy for us. We have a little service. What's the program?
We have time.
We have time?
Okay.
Yes, someone different? Someone who hasn't asked a question yet? Yes.
I wanted to say something what Prabhupada said about this balance between, you know, spontaneously serving Krishna in one sense, what one is inspired to do, and also then strictly following. Mm. I was listening to a very kind of interesting conversation with Prabhupada, and he was referring to something happened in Hawaii, and the temples then told the devotees, now go and do your own thing for Prabhupada. And Prabhupada seems kind of ironic about that. Yes, so now go and do your own thing on behalf of Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, you know, so he didn't like that.
Mm.
But on the other hand, there's also, there's talk about this morning, this, you know, can you say something? I mean,
Again, what you mentioned Hawaii, see, that was part of that letter I read, this Tushta Krishna and Siddha Sarup. Siddha Sarup started the first faction. You know, that was the first faction in ISKCON. It was before Prabhupada. It was when Prabhupada was here in the 70s, 1973, 1974. He had his followers, and he didn't like the way ISKCON was doing some of the things they were doing, which his ideas weren't always wrong, because we were going out on Sankirtan, so-called Sankirtan, and just, you know, telling a lot of lies and doing without anything, you know, to get the result. And he thought it was bad, you know, bad for the movement. And that was one of the things. But anyway, so he had broken away. Now, Prabhupada always encouraged Siddha Sarup, because he was telling people to chant Hare Krishna. So that's always good. He never discourage anyone. But the one thing he said to Sat Sarup in 74, and Sat Sarup started talking about Prabhupada, what about, you know, these, to deal with these factions. And Prabhupada said there are no factions. He said there's the order of the spiritual master, and you follow it, you're not following it. So there's no, you know, there's no gray area. There's no, you're either following Prabhupada's instructions or you're not. So, you know, individually anyone can do that. Just like your follower, you know, I'm Prabhupada's disciple. And I can be here, I can go sit in the park and chant Hare Krishna and give people the philosophy. If I'm following Prabhupada's instructions and understand and distributing Krishna consciousness and passing out his books, that's very good. Amen. But as soon as you're trying to give some different idea, that's bad. Spontaneity can be there. Prabhupada encouraged, right? So much people wanted to do something for Krishna. Prabhupada, you know, do it. It's very good. But give them the pure thing. That's our business, is just to give Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada didn't like again, diluting things, changing things, adding, you know, just to maybe increase it, you know, so we can get that. This is what, you know, this is what happened in New Vrindavan. You know, Kirtananandi brought in Christianity. You know, he had Jesus on the altar, and so many different things were going on because he had a better idea. Well, see, there's no better ideas. You just follow the previous acharyas, and you just give Krishna consciousness purely, and that's fine. And if you're doing that, then you're a follower of Srila Prabhupada. But Prabhupada didn't even like the word faction. You know, and he would sometimes even say, like he would talk about bogus. Prabhupada said, there is no bogus guru. You're a guru or you're not. The fact that you say bogus, then you're not a guru, are you? You're not a teacher. If you're teaching nonsense, then you're no guru. So he would say things like that, that it's, you know, it was very black and white. But it doesn't mean, you know, someone can practice Krishna consciousness in their home. It's not that everyone's supposed to be living in the temple. There should be so many people that there's no question there's enough room in the temple to house devotees. Devotees should be everywhere, inside the temple, outside the temple. But he would say different things. He would say, you know, like, just like if you're nearby the temple, he said it's redundant to have deities in your home. Deities are already here. Come to the temple, see the deities, he would say, you know, not separately that I have to have deities. He said that's redundant. So these questions were coming up as well. I'm in Hawaii at this time. It was always, but a lot of it had to do with control. You know, leaders wanted to control every action that was going on, especially like in the Grihastha community, you know, what Grihasthas were doing. But Prabhupada encouraged, you know, Grihasthas. What did he say in that one letter to that one devotee boy? If you're going to get married, he said your first business is
to
support your family. He said get a job and support your family. You know, not that you're a Hare Krishna and you're going to get married and live in the temple and live off the temple. He said we can't take care of it. He once said Grihastha. He said it's very difficult for Grihasthas. He said, we cannot pay them, nor can they work outside. He said, dilemma. So somehow, I mean, and it is, we need to have an infrastructure. We should have something where devotees can be engaged together with other devotees, working, making income, take care and raise a family. But he said, if you want to have a family, you want to be married, well, then you have to support your family. So all these things, but whatever we do, we always need association. You know, that's the thing, to go off on our own. Prabhupada said, if you're not associating with devotees, you're associating with non-devotees. You don't have a choice. You're either going to associate with devotees, or you're going to associate with non-devotees. Because our nature is, we're social. We're not going to stay, you know, for 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, go live somewhere alone, but that's, you know, that's illusion. We always have to have association. So whatever, you know, association is very important. So that also, we have to be particular who we associate with, even as devotees. And, so, does that answer your question? I hope. There's, you know, there's room for everything in Krishna consciousness, in a Krishna conscious way. But, you know, if someone goes off to some corner of the world and does very wonderful things, makes devotees, and it's wonderful, you know. ISKCON is not just buildings. It's not buildings. ISKCON is it's a consciousness, isn't it? International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Just to have buildings and have a stamp, you know, this is it, that doesn't make it ISKCON. What makes it is following Prabhupada's instructions. You know, that's ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Otherwise, if it's me consciousness, then that's no good. And Prabhupada would say you judge a thing by the results. I mean, we see, like I see so many devotees, and everywhere we go, now we see sincere devotees everywhere we go, and they may be so-called big devotees, or they may be just very simple, humble devotees that you would never even know they existed if you didn't go to that place. And we just have to be sincere devotees. So at the end of this life, you know, Prabhupada said, you can go back home, back to Godhead. That's ultimately what's important. I mean, we can't, we want to serve nicely, you know, help spread Krishna consciousness to the best of our ability according to our nature. We all have natures. Once in Hawaii, I told you I was president there in 77. In 1975, the president had left Hawaii. And that's when I also left Prabhupada's personal service. And they were saying, Nithai and Paramahamsa said to Prabhupada, maybe Shrutakirti would be temple president. And Prabhupada just smiled. He said, he's too easygoing. So that was, it wasn't a criticism. He was just describing my nature. I was easygoing. And easygoing and temple president don't go well together. You know, you have to, there has to be a degree of toughness, you know, managing a center. And like Prabhupada would say, you know, it's not a free hotel in Hawaii. You know, Hawaii was, you know, that was Hawaii. Imagine of all places, it was paradise. So they have a beautiful temple there that Ambarish bought for Prabhupada to do translation work. So they would say devotees come and you just had this, you know, you were living on a tropical island. You didn't need much, you know, little fruit, papayas, pineapples, avocados, or growing on trees, just pick them. And he said, the temple is not for lazies and crazies. And he said, we should work very hard for Krishna. He said, like the karmis, but for Krishna. So that's required in management. You can't, not just someone can come and take advantage, you know, Prabhupada called, you know, sleeping japa. Just sleep and do japa. No, it's meant, you know, it's meant for people that want to serve. He didn't want it to just become a place to house lazies, you know, in the name of devotee. So Hawaii was, I remember in those days, was, you know, it could be like that. Anywhere can be like that. You can take shelter in these places. But Prabhupada wanted, he wanted us to pick up his mood. Prabhupada was always busy. You know, always serving. Am I clear? Yes.
Yes, I was here.
Hare Krishna.
Yes, Hare Krishna. Yes, do you think that the Prabhupada will be the end of the of our sampradaya, in Acharya, the last Acharya in our sampradaya?
So I think.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know what to think. I don't know. I know this movement supposed to go on. He said his books would be books now for 10,000 years. That's a long, long time. Someone, there has to be good direction from someone. Krishna is always providing a direction in the form of his self and his pure devotees.
Otherwise it would be broken or something.
No, some Prabhupada would say that, you know, the acharya is self-effulgent. So when someone comes along self-effulgent, then you don't have to ask questions. It'll be clear. It'll be clear by just like when I talk about, you know, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhakti Vinod Thakur. You know, they could have said that, you know, after Bhakti Vinod Thakur left, was that going to be the last? You know, always, Krishna's always helping us.
You did ask Prabhupada about that, and he did say, yeah, you'll know.
Yeah.
You'll know.
That's what self-effulgent means. You know. You'll know when a person is there. But for us, we have the benefit of Srila Prabhupada. He was, you know, just right there. Just 30 years ago, all his books were there. He said, I gave everything in my books. You know, and that's what's important, is to know that, to read Prabhupada's books, you know, to really read them. And take association from advanced devotees, those that can enthuse you to advance in Krishna consciousness. You know, Prabhupada's presence is there. We can feel Prabhupada's presence. Sometimes I do. I always know Prabhupada's guiding me. And very often we know what to do. We know what's right, we know what's wrong. It's not such a difficult thing. Prabhupada would say that. Krishna consciousness is common sense. That means it's not very difficult, is it? You know? Okay. Yes.